So the title of my talk is Plan B, Mississippi. And this is a part of a project that's been ongoing for some time now. I'm trying to understand the nature and rational dynamics of backup planning. Right? So you put in place a plan for what you do in the scenario in which you give up on a primary plan that you have. After all, you know, the best laid plans of mice and men, off go awry, your evening doesn't work, you know, your picnic gets rained out, your flight gets canceled, and maybe more importantly, your career might hit a dead end, your marriage might dissolve. And at least we humans can anticipate these factors sometimes. And so it's sensible for us to at least, you know, sometimes put a plan in place for the case in which that happens in order to avoid the worst case scenario of, you know, abandoning your primary plan and not having any developed plans to be able to do that. So I'd like to understand what backup plans are and how they're related to our primary plans and how we should think more generally about planning in the face of uncertainty about what we'll be able to do. After all, it only makes sense to invest significantly in a backup plan if you are entertaining serious doubt that your primary plan will work out. I don't mean to deny that it can make sense to take precautions, even if you're really quite confident that you'll be able to pull it off. You might want some minimal insurance against the possibility of being wrong. But in many cases, you know, when we want to invest significant agential resources into our backup plan, right? We might want to, you know, put time and effort and money into making the plans and furthering them. I think that really only makes sense if we are in serious doubt about our ability to pull off the A plan. But it's quite striking in the literature on planning and plan rationality, which is often formulated in terms of intention, when you intend to do something. This literature, I think, usually doesn't make any explicit reference to the possibility of backup planning. That's already a striking fact because it's quite obviously something that we do all the time. But more importantly, I think this literature often doesn't even make room for backup planning being rationally permissible. And the reason is that it's at least some kinds of theories in plan rationality want to tie planning together with knowing what you'll do, or at least believing that you will carry out your plans. So David Goleman, for example, claims that, you know, when you intend to do something, plan to do it, you're in a plan state, you at least, you know, need to believe that you'll succeed in carrying out the plan. In a good case, you know that you'll do it, right? And he makes the claim that you're only ever subject to norms of plan rationality, like, you know, intend the means to your ends and, you know, ensure that your intentions are all consistent with one another and your beliefs. He argues that that's only because you believe that you will carry out your plan, right? Such that if you didn't have that belief, then these norms of plan rationality wouldn't apply. Yeah. Other people who make arguments like that include Kieran Setia, Barry Marusich, John Strangler. So there's this one strand of theorizing about planning where sort of planning and plan rationality goes tightly together with believing that you'll do the thing. That clearly sort of leaves no room for backup planning. Other views don't want to be committed to that point, but say that nevertheless, when we engage in further planning, even if we entertain doubt that we'll succeed in our plans, we need to rely on the assumption that we'll succeed in order to plan for the future. So Michael Bratton says something like this. Facundo Alonso has a recent paper where he argues for this. So, you know, either way, what we get is a picture of planning for the future, where you either need to believe you'll carry out your plans or rely on the assumption that you will. What I'm interested in is what I want to call agnostic planning, where neither of those assumptions holds. You don't believe you'll succeed. You entertain serious doubt about your ability to pull off your plan. You don't believe you'll fail, right? But you're sort of agnostic about it. And you're not willing to rely on anything that you'll succeed, precisely because you want to protect yourself against the worst case scenario in which you fail and you have no alternative left. And so I guess my more general project is to understand what agnostic planning should look like and how it might differ from what we might call confident planning, where you do believe that you'll carry out your plans. Okay, so that's sort of where this project is located in my overall interest. The question of what the rational norms are that govern agronomic planning is very vague, and I'm not going to take on the whole question today. But what I'm specifically interested in are norms of consistency, and whether and to what extent our backup plans rationally ought to be consistent with our primary plans. I'm interested in whether there's something distinctive about backup planning that either requires a kind of inconsistency in our thinking. Like, after all, we're planning for multiple distinct futures that we don't believe you will occupy all of them together. And so there's a sense in which I think backup planning involves really a kind of disunity or compartmentalization. At the same time, what I want to suggest is that there are actually distinctive pressures toward kind of consistency that come in when we engage in backup planning that we don't necessarily see when we're just looking at the relationships between our primary plans. But I think sometimes we feel a kind of tension or stigma about backup planning, such that if you're really committed to your primary plan, really committed to this career, marriage, whatever, then you wouldn't be engaging in backup planning at all. And so what I want to understand is where that tension or stigma is coming from and how we can articulate that in terms of plan rationality. Okay, let me just say a little bit more about this term I've been using, plan rationality. I should say more specifically what I mean by that. What I have in mind is a broadly structural notion, because people these days like to distinguish between structural and substantive rationality. Not sure I like this distinction, but what I have in mind is more on the structural side, by which I mean it's a notion of rationality that's concerned with the coherence or the relationship between a thinker's attitudes, whether or not those attitudes are the ones she ought to have, just looking at the relationships with one another, as opposed to a notion of substantive rationality, which is concerned with your reasons for having certain attitudes in the first place, and whether, you know, given your evidence, you should have the beliefs that you have, or, you know, given your practical reasons, what should you do? So practical rationality is a structural notion. And it's important that we try to stay, therefore, sort of in that space. And I say that because I think it's actually quite tricky in the kind of cases I want to think about sometimes to disentangle the more ethical or conventional pressures that can come in and also kind of enjoin consistency or, you know, otherwise affect our intuitions about the cases. And it can be a little bit tricky because on the one hand, again, in the kind of literature that I want to engage with on plan rationality, a lot of times the very idea of a plan state, again, normally referred to as an intention, but I want to set aside the word intention here. That very idea is often picked out by reference to certain rational requirements that are said to apply to the state. So, you know, if you intend or plan, then you're subject to instrumental norms of means and coherence and consistency. And that's what sort of gives us our grip on the state. I don't want to do that because the very question I want to raise is, you know, what are the norms that apply to plan states that don't involve the belief that you'll pull off the plan? But at the same time, I want to stay within the purview of plan rationality and not start doing substantive ethics. So that's just to say, that's what I'm going for with the methodology, and should feel free to call me out if you think I'm veering away from that. Okay, all right, with all of that in place, then let's get going. So I think a good place to start anyway is to think about the norms or the requirements that are usually said to apply to intentions that enjoin a kind of consistency between your intentions and your beliefs, right? So there are different ways to formulate these requirements, but here's one, call this the intention belief consistency norm. Rationally speaking, you ought not to intend to do A, intend to do B, and believe that if you do A, you will therefore not B, or vice versa, right? The general intuition is that your intentions should be consistent with your beliefs, such that you don't set yourself up to intend to do multiple things that you also believe you can't do all together, or that you won't do all together. You shouldn't intend to win the foot race tomorrow and also intend to shoot yourself in the foot, believing that these two things are incompatible, and that if you shoot yourself in the foot, you won't win the foot race. Okay, so at first glance, we could try to generate a puzzle by saying, well, look, you're setting aside the word intention and just substituting plan states for intention here. There's a sense in which this is exactly the situation we're in when we engage in backup planning, right? So I'm planning to have a pleasant afternoon with friends, let's say, and I'm planning to do this by having a picnic in the park, right? But I might worry about rain and think, well, if it rains, then we'll go to the movies instead. But, you know, if I go have the picnic, if it doesn't rain and I go have the picnic, then to that extent, you know, because I go have the picnic, I won't go to the movies, right? I don't believe I'll do these things together. And I believe that, like, the fact that I had the picnic in part explains why I didn't go to the movies, right? And so there's a sense in which it looks like when we engage in backup planning, again, we're planning for these different incompatible futures, we don't believe we're going to do both things. And we actually believe that the reason we won't do both things is because we will only do one of them. So it looks like maybe backup planning violates consistency requirements, and maybe that's okay. Maybe what we should conclude is that, yeah, backup plans don't need to be consistent with our primary plan. But that's not right. That's actually kind of a specious argument. It's actually pretty simple, I think, although not as simple as it looks at first glance, to show how our backup plans can be at least logically consistent with our primary plans and our beliefs, and thereby satisfy consistency norm like the one on the handout, if we just make the backup plan conditional on the abandonment of the A plan. All right, so that seems like the obvious solution. So we say, well, look, you know, the plan isn't to do B. The plan is to do B if I give up on the A plan for whatever reason. And by making the backup plan conditional on the abandonment of the A plan, then we sort of keep them compartmentalized from one another, and there need be no logical inconsistency here. Okay. Some people have said, actually, that as soon as you encounter uncertainty about whether you'll be able to pull off your plans, then all of your planning needs to be conditional, even your A plan, right? So all you can do at that point is just make a bunch of conditional plans and, in a sense, wait to find out what the conditions are. I don't think that's right. I don't think the A plan has to be conditional, and I can say more about that in the Q&A if you'd like. But I do think the B plan has to be conditional on the abandonment of the A plan, and I think that's all we really need in order to get a kind of consistency here. Okay, problem solved. Not exactly. I think it's actually a little bit more tricky than that. And part of the reason, I think there's a general criticism to be made here of norms or requirements of rationality that are formulated only by making reference to our goals or our ends, right? Because after all, actions are almost always these temporally extended processes, right? And you can be doing many actions at the same time. The plan rationality norm that we're looking at least one way to interpret it, the most natural way to interpret it, is that you need to ensure that the thing you are attempting to do, the thing you're attempting to succeed at, those goals all need to be mutually possible, such that you could succeed at all of these actions in the same world. But that ignores the fact that there could be ways of pursuing these actions such that even if the goals are mutually compatible, the processes are not, right? So it could be that it's possible to succeed at everything you are planning to do, but the ways in which you go about pursuing these goals could conflict with one another. And so I actually think in general, the way to bring this out is to think about the fact that, look, it's not necessarily the case that when you make a backup plan, you shouldn't do anything about it until the point at which you abandon your primary plan. Sometimes what you should do is take some steps toward sort of investing in the backup plan and furthering the plan, putting it in motion, getting it sort of some way down the road, even though you're still pursuing the primary plan. Let's try to think through an example. So, you know, let's suppose your primary plan is to become a stand-up comedian, who's actually profitable, who sort of performs enough and makes enough money that you can support yourself. So not just any stand-up comedian, but a sort of profitable one. But you're deeply uncertain about whether you'll be able to do this. Okay. And your backup plan is to become a chef. The backup plan to become a chef is, it's a backup to the primary plan because in some sense, they're both aimed at accomplishing the same goal. Although in some cases, this is going to be at a very high level of description. Like they're both aimed at accomplishing the goal of having a fulfilling and profitable career or something like that. I think it would make sense to go ahead and learn how to cook, even if you are still pursuing your goal of becoming a stand-up comedian, right? You might also take some cooking classes and otherwise sort of put yourself in a position so that you're not starting from scratch at the point, you know, if and when you give up on the career in comedy. You might even take, you know, some money that you could use to further your career in comedy. You know, you could hire, you could take more improv classes and you could put the money toward becoming a better comedian, but it might nevertheless make sense to put that money toward sort of furthering the backup plan instead. Okay, and so the point is that when we say that the backup plan is conditional on the abandonment of the primary plan, there's a kind of ambiguity there. Do we mean it's conditional on, you don't even begin the backup plan until you've abandoned the primary plan? I want to say the answer is no, that's not necessarily how we should understand the conditional aspect of the backup plan. It can make sense to begin pursuing the backup plan even while we're in the primary plan. And so essentially what we need to do is somehow, we need the norm to make reference to actions in progress. And a rational agent will pursue only those parts of the backup plan that she thinks will not prevent her from succeeding with the primary plan. So, you know, the would-be comedian might do quite a bit to further the possibility of becoming a chef, but she's not going to, let's say, take these cooking classes in the evenings when all the comedy gigs happen, such that it would prevent her from even accepting a gig that was offered to her and so forth. So it's going to be a little bit more complicated than just supposing that these plans are completely compartmentalized from one another and you only do the one after you've given up on the primary plan. You can be involved in both of them at the same time, I want to say. Even if you think, you know, in the end, you're not going to complete these plans together, you can be engaged in both of them at the same time. And the parts, and only those parts of the B plan that are, the agent believes to be, in some sense, incompatible with succeeding at the A plan, those should be compartmentalized such that she won't do those until she abandons the A plan. So, but the other parts of the B plan that are not sort of strictly incompatible, it can be rationally permissible to engage in. So, on the one hand, what I want to say here is that it's actually not that difficult to ensure that our backup plans are logically consistent with our primary plan. It's a little bit more complicated than it first appears. You have to sort of be more nuanced about exactly what the conditional structure is with the B plan. It's not, the whole plan isn't conditional on the abandonment of the A plan. But nevertheless, we can make sure that there's sort of mere co-possibility is protected here. Is that the end of the investigation? I want to say no. That's really just the beginning of it, because I think that's actually a very, it's not a very satisfying point, and I feel as though there's something really important left over that hasn't been explained yet, and that can't be explained simply by appealing to these very minimal rational requirements enjoining logical consistency between our plans and our beliefs. We, as I mentioned earlier, I think we do often stigmatize backup planning and feel as though there's a tension. And it's not because we somehow suspect that the backup plan is not sort of co-possible with the primary plan. So a tempting example, it's also sort of noisy, but I sort of can't help referring back to it. Most people refuse to get prenuptial or postnuptial agreements for the case of divorce, even though it's sort of widely known that, let's say, at least 50% of marriages end in divorce. A little more nuanced than that, but that's a common belief anyway. And yet approximately like 10% of people make an agreement for what to do, how to divide assets and debts in the case of divorce. And this is a classic example in which it's sort of built into the structure of the prenuptial agreement that nothing will happen unless you decide to divorce. The agreement does nothing until you get to that point of abandoning the A plan of staying in the relationship. And it doesn't need to cost very much to get a prenuptial agreement. I think I just downloaded a form off the internet and I'm not totally sure it's legally binding, but you know, you don't need to invest a lot of resources in it. And so it seems as though there's a simple dominance argument to be given in favor of getting it. And yet people don't. Why not? There's a lot going on here. And as I mentioned at the outset, you know, we have to be really careful to try to separate out the kind of ethical and conventional pressures that can be affecting our intuition. So in the case of marriage, you know, there are kind of social expectations, I think, that get in the way here. But I think part of what's going on really is that we think if you were really committed to the marriage, then you wouldn't be planning for failure. You wouldn't be investing any resources at all in that contingency. So there's a felt inconsistency, I want to say, not between sort of the contents of the plan to stay married and the plan for what to do in the case of divorce, but rather in sort of the degree of commitment that you're exhibiting in the primary plan and in the backup plan. I think there's a tension there. And that's what I want to try to bring out. Okay. Another thing that could be going on in the marriage case that I want to set aside, that often I think when we feel this dissatisfaction with backup planning, really what we're targeting are the agent's beliefs. So we think that the agent shouldn't be as doubtful as she is. She ought to be confident that her marriage will succeed, let's say. And that's the thing that we are unhappy about. That, however, would be really a question for a theory of substantive rationality. So, you know, if we're making the claim that the agent should have different beliefs than she actually does, given her evidence or given her practical reasons, I think that would be outside the purview of structural rationality. And so what I'd like to do is try to set aside, we're trying to hold fixed the agent's beliefs and just think about, you know, given what she believes, can we make sense of a felt inconsistency between primary plans and backup planning in some of these cases? Well, one thing we might want to do is go beyond the sort of minimal requirement that our plans just be sort of logically co-possible, that we don't have an outright logical inconsistency in our plans and our beliefs. We might want to say more than that. We might want a theory of rationality that can allow us to say that some people are more coherent than others, not just that some people are coherent in this minimal sense and some and the rest are incoherent. We might want a notion of rationality that comes to degrees, and we might want a notion of rationality that allows us to say something about cases in which our plans are not an outright conflict, but they're in kind of competition with one another. They're competing for agential resources. Okay, and so that's what I'd like to try to do next. In order to do that, I'm gonna stop talking about rational requirements. And instead, I'm gonna start talking about a notion that I'll call rational pressure, pro tanto rational pressure. And this is meant to be a notion that comes in degrees so that we can say there's sort of more or less rational pressure, let's say in favor of some combinations of attitudes or against some other combinations of attitudes. It's a directional notion. So it's not wide scope, I suppose, as some people say these rational requirements are. And the nice thing about the idea of rational pressure is that it allows us to then say, I think, more nuanced things. We can talk again about sort of being more or less rational, more or less coherent. We can do kind of more complicated things with this notion. And it also allows us the flexibility to then say, you know, depending on our interests and our purposes, we can set thresholds for when we want to say some combination of attitudes is outright prohibited, or outright required or permissible. We can kind of play around, I think, with thresholds where we can say, well, you know, beyond this threshold, you've gone too far, and now you're just irrational. But, you know, and that might depend on our interests here. All right, so now let me try to put this claim to work. So the first thing I want to say is that a backup plan and a primary plan can be more or less consistent with one another. And this is not just a matter of, again, sort of thinking that the backup plan, pursuing the backup plan will prevent you from succeeding at the primary plan, but sometimes it's just that pursuing the backup plan will causally interfere with succeeding at the primary plan, such that you could succeed at both, right? Even sort of just doing part of the backup plan, you could succeed at doing that part while still succeeding at the A plan. But it's just that the backup plan takes away from your ability to some extent to succeed at the primary plan. So, you know, earlier I tried to give an extreme example of inconsistency, which is, you know, planning to win the foot race and also planning to shoot yourself in the foot. That's, you know, the extreme case of undermining your own agency. But we might have a less extreme case where, I don't know, you plan to win the foot race tomorrow and you plan to have a heavy night of drinking tonight. And you think it's still possible to win the foot race tomorrow. You know, it's not outright impossible, but it's just less likely, you might think. And to that extent, you know, these two plans compete with one another. The one takes away from the other. Okay, and so that's just a general observation about plans. This doesn't necessarily pertain only to backup plans. In general, we can have multiple plans that compete with one another, such that the pursuit of one can causally interfere with your ability to succeed at the others. And that's okay, that's life. But I wanna say that the threshold for permissible conflict in the case of backup plans and primary plans is lower wherever it goes. And again, I think this is just, you know, potentially context dependent, but wherever it goes, the threshold is lower for a backup plan drawing resources away from the primary plan and otherwise sort of interfering with your ability to succeed at the primary plan. When it comes to having just multiple primary plans, you know, you plan to be, you know, a great colleague and do a great job at work, and you plan to have a successful, loving, present marriage at home, and you plan to be a good parent, and you find yourself like pulled in all these different directions, and you know these plans are all competing with one another. So that's, you know, that's something that we encounter all the time, and I think in that kind of case, you know, the thing that makes it different from the backup plan case is that when you put in place a backup plan, you've explicitly compared the two plans. They're both plans to achieve the same goal, and you've ranked the backup plan for whatever reason as being sort of below the primary plan. And so it's sort of encoded in the structure of these plans that it wouldn't make sense to sacrifice a great deal for the pursuit of your A plan in order to further the B plan. I think there can be some trade-offs here, again, as I said before, where you are sort of decreasing the likelihood of succeeding at the A plan by investing in the B plan. So I don't think competition is ruled out, right? But I think there's rational pressure against it, and the threshold for permissible pressure here is lower than in the more general case of plan competition, all right? And plausibly, structural rationality doesn't tell us how to revise our primary plans when they come into conflict with one another. It just says, get your plans in order, like figure it out, you know, adjust one or another. But I think when backup plans conflict with primary plans, then there's strong default pressure to revise the backup plan and not the primary plan. Okay. The flip side of this is that a B plan is going to be more harmonious. There's sort of rational pressure in favor of a backup plan that, you know, requires you to do certain things that are useful for lots of your other plans. So learning how to cook, good if you want a career as a chef, but it's actually just useful in general for your plan to feed yourself. And so to that extent, the point here is that we, in looking at consistency and rational pressures and joining sort of harmony between the plans and sort of using your agential resources in a way that's sort of not overly divisive, a B plan will be better if it sort of accords with lots of your primary plans. It doesn't have to accord with the A plan that it's sort of, that is his partner. Okay, sorry. Let me move on now to the idea of strength of commitment. So one of the things that I'm most interested in here is the idea that in order to really make sense of this phenomenon, we need to help ourselves to the idea that you can be more or less committed to a goal. I don't want to insist that this is an irreducible, sui generis, like, psychological phenomenon. I'm open to the idea that when we talk about being more or less committed, so, you know, I'm somewhat committed to staying in my current job, not really committed to going to the Eastern APA, you know, but I'm really, really committed to, you know, making sure that, you know, my kid has a good education. You know, we talk this way all the time. I'm open to the idea that this reduces to something else, but I think it's kind of notable that we usually don't see this notion in our theories of agency and rationality. And I keep finding myself coming back to it as something that's really explanatorily important. So I guess the one thing I do want to insist on today is that to understand strength of commitment, it would be a mistake to suppose that commitment goes in lockstep with confidence. So that if you're less committed to something, then you're less confident that you'll achieve it. And if you're more committed, then you're more confident. I think clearly the level of your commitment might be relevant to your expectations about whether you'll succeed. But I think you can be very, very committed to something that you think is very unlikely you'll be able to do. You know, think of certain kinds of political activism where you kind of think, I'm so committed to ending racism, but you know, it's not as though you have to think that this is especially likely in your lifetime. Or you can be very like modestly committed to something that you think would be easy, like tossing a wadded up piece of paper into a trash can, something like that. Okay, I want to say that commitment and your expectations of success are not orthogonal to one another, certainly not. There's no direct relationship. But what I want to explore now is the idea that, again, a backup plan can be inconsistent with the strength of your commitment to the primary plan. The best way to make sense of this, I think, is to note that a backup plan can pose a temptation to give up on the primary plan, or in general, pose a substantial risk of trying less hard than, in some sense, you originally set out to do, or that you're in some sense committed to doing, right? In these cases, it's not as though you expect yourself to succeed at the A plan. After all, right, by hypothesis, you're entertaining serious doubt to begin with. So you're already, in some sense, baking in the idea that you might give up. You might just find that after years of trying to make it in comedy, it's gonna be time to throw in the towel. And that's something that you're keenly aware of all along. And so it's not that giving up on the A plan is necessarily a failure, but it might be a failure if you give up, as it were, too soon or in the wrong way, under the wrong circumstances, because in response to the wrong kind of reason, I suppose. And I think there are some cases of backup planning that put you at risk of precisely that. So, you know, I mean, first, when you put in place a backup plan, part of what you've done, I think, is at least hopefully you've convinced yourself that the B plan would be pretty good. You know, it's not as good as the A plan, as succeeding at the A plan, but you certainly think it's better. Succeeding at the B plan is better than the scenario in which you're just sort of left with no good alternative. And that can be kind of a short step to coming to prefer the B plan when things get difficult with the A plan, right? So, I mean, maybe a kind of extreme example, you know, suppose you're an addict and you're trying to get sober and you're going to the party tonight and your plan is to drink nothing, but you might be very worried about your ability to stay sober at the party. I think it would make sense to engage in some backup planning in this scenario, but I think a bad backup plan would be something like, I'll plan to have only one drink tonight because when you're there, and of course you're very tempted to drink, the one drink plan is going to seem a lot better than the no drinks plan, at least potentially. And I mean, you might think, yeah, the case of addiction is again quite noisy, but I think more generally, certain kinds of backup plans that we might call fallback plans are going to constitute this risk as well. So a fallback plan, as I'm thinking about it, is a plan where you do a proper part of the A plan. So, you know, you're pursuing a PhD in philosophy, let's say hypothetically, and then you might think, well, you know, if that doesn't work out, if I find that I need to abandon this plan, at least I can leave with a master's, something like that. Or my plan is to run the marathon, but my backup plan is to run half of the marathon. So that kind of plan can make a lot of sense. It doesn't compete at all with the primary plan. And to that extent, it's a very efficient use of your agential resources. There's no need for any kind of disagglomerated or disunified planning. But I do think that kind of planning does also sometimes pose a risk of, you know, you're really tired of that half marathon mark and you've set yourself up to think, yeah, a half marathon's pretty good. So there's a risk here of tempting yourself to try less hard to achieve your plan than you initially aimed to. Now this is the problem if you're strongly committed to succeeding at the A plan, then you need to make sure that you don't put yourself at risk of this kind of temptation. In ways that if you're sort of not very strongly committed to the A plan, then perhaps it doesn't matter very much. Perhaps it's fine to kind of to have these backup plans, which are otherwise very useful. The fact that they might tempt you toward the backup plan and away from the A plan might not matter very much. Other kinds of inconsistencies here, I think, can involve the risk of just really vividly focusing on giving up. You know, it can be demoralizing, right? I mean, you're kind of like, there's something almost, it's not quite Moore's paradoxical, but there's a kind of tension in both kind of thinking I'm really, really committed to this marriage, really dwelling on all of these possible circumstances in which you would want to leave and imagining these things that your spouse might do, they haven't done it yet, but you're just really kind of fleshing out this scenario in a lot of detail. That could be, I think, really destructive to the health of the marriage. And that's in just kind of a psychological point. But again, there might then be reason not to engage in certain kinds of backup plans that would require really dwelling on what failure would look like and fleshing out these details. You can make certain miscalculations. So it might be, you know, that the permissible level of kind of allocating agential resources to the B plan, you could overshoot the mark by, you know. So these are all meant to be risks that you incur by engaging in certain kinds of backup plans. And this is a special case of the thing I said earlier, that more generally, sort of there's rational pressure to avoid causal interference such that the backup plan interferes with your ability to succeed at the primary plan. But there are a couple of reasons why I think it's worth highlighting these cases. For one thing, we can really only make sense of them if we take into account the agent's sort of own limitations. In other words, if we thought that plan rationality was only a matter of looking at the contents of an agent's plans and making sure that they all fit together in minimally coherent ways, then we would miss out on these kinds of cases where the problem isn't with the content. Like the contents of these plans that I mentioned, you know, again, they're all conceivably fine. It's only once the agent takes into account her own sort of, you know, that she's prone to temptation or despair or procrastination or other kinds of vicissitudes and foibles, only then can we see that there's a kind of problem with the planning. And so I think that's really worth noting. And I think it shows us something about how we should understand this notion of plan rationality, that it can't just be this very abstract idea. It really should be a notion that sort of takes into account certain facts about the kinds of agents that we are. Okay, and so that's I guess maybe all I'll say about that in the interest of time. Ray, how much more is it? 5 minutes? Okay, that's fine. Really quickly, let me just say a couple more things about the topic. So I think a sort of discomfort that people have sometimes, or I don't know, this is a related kind of discomfort with backup planning, is that they fear that the backup plan is really a kind of exit strategy. That, and this is related to my invocation of degrees of commitment. So the worry is that if you have this plan B, you have this prenup, or you know, you've already applied to law school and taken the LSAT, even though you say you're committed to this career in philosophy. One thing we might come to suspect is that you're really not very committed at all. And in fact, what you're doing is putting in place the ability to leave, which in some sense you already have one foot out the door, let's say. And so I think there can be a kind of interpersonal uncertainty here where, especially, you know, if I care a lot about whether you're committed to this relationship or this career or whatever it is, then the fact that you're engaging in backup planning might make me worry because I'm actually uncertain about the degree of your commitment. And then we can take that point a step further and notice that it's actually really hard, even sort of in the first person, like intrapersonal case, to know how committed you are to something, or it can be. I think this is the kind of worry we can have about ourselves. Like, how committed am I really when the chips are down and things get difficult? Like, I think this is something that it can be very difficult to know. And it's not clear to me that we can just directly sort of introspect this kind of thing. And so one thing then that we can do to at the least perform commitment, but maybe manifest commitment, and this is the thing that I'm uncertain about, is to refuse to backup plan. So one thing I can do to convince you, and maybe myself, if I'm in doubt, that I am really committed to this career, is just to refuse to put in place any kind of safety net for failure, to raise the stakes on myself, so to speak, so that my only good option is to succeed and there is no competition, you know, with the primary plan. I show that I'm all in. And I can do that to show you, but I might do it to show myself. And so having noticed that, then I think, you know, for the purposes of my project, we need to ask the question, you know, what's going on there? That one way to understand that phenomenon is to think, actually, sort of refusing to backup plan is in some sense a constitutive of being really committed. It's a manifestation of it, so that there would be a kind of more direct relationship than the ones that I've pointed to, between how committed you are and how permissible it is for you to engage in backup planning. So that if you're really committed, you shouldn't do it. But it, on the other hand, we could understand the phenomenon as just something like, yeah, one way to perform commitment or to sort of act it out is to refuse to engage in backup planning, but the two things are metaphysically separate, so to speak. I'm not really sure what I think about this, but so I wanted to just bring it for discussion. I tend to think, look, you know, some types of backup planning go hand in hand with being strongly committed in the sense that you want to make sure that you achieve your goal, if not by hook, then by crook, right? So you're like, well, I'm really committed to, you know, yeah, the classic example, moving this log, and if I can't do it by hand, I'm going to use the truck. And so those kinds of backup plans, I think, pose no threat to commitment. It's really more the ones where, in some sense, and this is now kind of getting to the last point on the handout that I'm just going to gesture towards, the ones that really give us pause are the ones in which the backup plan kind of almost constitutes like a very different life or a very different self that you might be if you went that direction rather than in the direction that you in the direction of the primary approach, right? So the life of a chef is very different from the life of a comedian, and you know, getting divorced constitutes a very different path for you to take, where in some sense you're sort of at the limit of transforming from the one thing into the other. And I think in those kinds of cases, that's where the kind of it's harder to say that kind of the backup planning is somehow like separate. Sorry, what I want to say is like there's more temptation to understand the commitment as going hand in hand with sort of not having the backup plan, because you're sort of, insofar as you're even willing to entertain this other self, this other life, this sort of very disunified attitude toward the future and the world, there's something already a little bit problematic, I think, with your commitment. And so at the least, I think we're gonna have to be more specific about different kinds of backup plans in order to take on this point. I'll stop there, and I can't wait to hear what you guys think.